Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 47 of Groove, the No Trouble podcast, which you can always find at notrouble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
Hi, I'm Yannick Gwizdala, and I am a musician who just happens to play the bass.
Gwizdala is an awesome last name.
Well, it might be, not if you've been stuck with it for almost 40 years.
Right, you've had the crap beaten out of you enough to not appreciate it, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's that kind of typical Eastern European, here's a handful of consonants, we're going to give you one vowel and let you deal with it for the rest of your life.
What's the lineage on it?
Polish, my father's side of the family. My grandfather is the last one on that side to be born in Poland. But yeah, that's where it comes from.
That's a great name. So I was trying to figure out where I wanted to start in this conversation with you. And I was flipping through your YouTube channel, and I don't know why I got, and by the way, I always tell people that this show really is about you, the artist and the musician. I try and stay away from anything technical or chops or who your sponsors are. Okay. Because I like the content of like figuring out who the musician is and the artist. But yet, I don't know why, I went down the rabbit hole of your videos on High Action and John Patitucci. And yeah. I was just like, I was completely mesmerized by you talking about how high your action is. And I was like, what's wrong with me? Why do I enjoy this so much?
I don't know. Maybe it's a morbid fascination some people have with like the... you know, the technical approach of people they follow or admire or are aware of. I guess I had that when I was a kid, although that interaction or that content or that information was delivered a lot slower than it is today, obviously. You know, I actually had to go to shows and walk up to people on a stage and actually look at their bass rather than just do a quick Google search. So I guess I had kind of the analog version of that when I was younger. But I don't know. It's definitely been a fascination. It's something people, the reason I put the video up was because people were commenting on it so much in my Instagram videos and like, wow, your action's really high. What's up with that?
I find it amazing too, because as a writer, and I've written books and stuff like that, I always feel like things like that are like, what type of pen do you use? Or what type of notebook do you use? Like, it has nothing to do with the player and the skills. And yet, it's a very interesting human nature. And I think especially with musicians, like the gauge of the strings and the action and where the frets are placed and where the pickups are placed and where, why are we like that? Do we feel like there's a secret sauce in there that maybe we didn't see? Like, what is going on in that?
Well, nobody wants to do the work. I think that's, no, I'm serious. I'm deadly serious. That's really the common thread through it all, because everyone is looking for the quick route. The easy fix, I guess what is it now? The term is hack, right? Life hack. People are looking for that way to get around doing the work. And I always tell the story of, you know, along those lines of when I was a kid listening to the radio and the amount of time it took me from one, I remember very specifically the album. It was John McLaughlin with Joey DeFrancesco and Dennis Chambers playing Little Miss Valley. And it got played on Jazz FM on the radio in London by a guy called Mike Chadwick, who incidentally manages Snarky Puppy now, and is kind of connected to the bass world like that. He played that song. I jumped out of bed, wrote it down, and this was like on a Tuesday night. I then had to save sufficient money to go out and buy the physical product, and that didn't happen until Saturday. So there were kind of 4 or 5 days that passed between hearing the music for the first time and then getting to hear it again and really study it. Now I find myself screaming at either my, you know, cell phone carrier because the connection isn't as fast as I want it, or Spotify because it didn't happen in kind of less than 3 seconds. So I think people have kind of got sucked into that, and they don't particularly want to do the work. And there's so much information out there as well, I think, that it's kind of easy not to do the work these days.
It's interesting to hear you say that, Yana, because I think back to when I was in my teens and just starting to play, and you'd sort of go to the one or two shops that there were in the city
Right.
And you'd look through the books and, like, let's face it, I know you've written your share of books on this topic, but back then, slim pickings. I mean, there was great stuff, Jerry Jermotte, things like that, but slim pickings. And you sort of really were on your own unless you happened to stumble onto a teacher who was local, who was good, who you could afford, who would give you the time. I mean, I've had Alain Caron on the show from UZEB, and, you know, where I live in Montreal, like, he was the guy. I couldn't afford to take lessons with him. And plus, I don't even think I probably wouldn't have been good enough to take lessons with him. And now when I think about things like YouTube and just subscribing to people's channels, whether it's yours or someone else's, that it's true. If you're starting today and you want to play, the access and the speed of which you can pick things up is it's just frenetic, the pace.
It is. And I think I don't want to be like all dark on technology, because I'm not at all. I'm a huge fan of it. And I think there are a lot of positive things that go with access to such vast amounts of information. But I also think that part of the process gets a little lost. And I think we're seeing that a lot in the quality of music being produced and in the amount of responsibility that artists are taking these days with the art they create. And I feel they're not taking as much responsibility as perhaps artists of 30 or 40 years ago, when this current infrastructure and framework didn't exist.
What do you mean by that, though? What part of the process do you feel is being taken for granted?
I think that, well, the attention span, first of all. I think that people... It's obvious, I think everyone knows this, whether you're a creator or a viewer or a user or a subscriber, that the average attention span is very, very short. I mean, I seem to remember years and years ago, like pre-2010, YouTube had been around for 4 or 5 years. I seem to remember, maybe I'm wrong, but I seem to remember this quite vividly, seeing a statistic that the average retention on a YouTube video was kind of 2 minutes. Like, people would stick around for 2 minutes and then they would bounce. And then Instagram kind of got the whole 15-second market together with Instagram stories. And before Instagram feed videos were 60 seconds, they were 15 seconds. So then the attention span really, really diminished. So I think there's a lot of kind of shock and awe value going into the thought process and the creative process in order to hold people's attention. So I don't see too much long form art being developed right now. You know, things that you actually need to listen to an album from start to finish. I mean, and I'm super, I'm by no means exempt from that. I can't remember the last time I listened to a record from start to finish on a regular basis. Like I know I used to. Like, I used to grab a record and then wear it out over the course of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks and just listen to it over and over and over again and get deeply inside it. So I think that part of the creative process is getting a little lost.
Okay, well, I'm going to disabuse you of that and put your mind at ease as someone who works professionally in the space of monitoring this content and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Literally, I just came back from giving a big presentation at Content Marketing World where we talk about this. And the value and power of long-form content is greater than ever. So think about things like playlists. Where people are now, you know, 2, 3, 4, 15-hour playlists that they put on shuffle and go all day on. Binge watching. You know, it comes to some people come back over the weekend, they watch 14 hours of Green Arrow, who knows what, right?
Right.
And I would even argue your videos. I mean, I spent 15 minutes watching you talk about high action on a bass. That's not exactly, snackable content, as we say in the biz.
Right, but then look at the numbers, like look at the amount of subscribers I have versus somebody who's actually got like 500,000 or 1 million or 10 million subscribers, or people who are like, who are doing mass numbers, people who are taking the place of, you know, record companies and content providers of 20 to 30 years ago. I'm a small drop in the ocean. I'm a small niche. So yeah, I'm creating content and I'm definitely engaging an audience. And I would say I have a higher value in my audience of almost 50,000 people on YouTube than perhaps some people who have 500,000 followers on YouTube, because a lot of that is just chaff, basically. And the percentage rate of the people with those, some people anyway, with those higher subscriber rates are not as engaged as perhaps my low number of subscribers, but a higher number of engaged users. But still, I think it's a niche, and I think it is less common than common. I don't know.
I want to talk, it's funny, usually I want to talk about like where you started with the instrument. We'll get to that, but I'm actually super curious. I'm really curious about YouTube. I mean, you talked about, you know, having close to 50,000 subscribers. You've got, you know, over 5.5 million views aggregate and growing at a really rapid clip. So I'm curious about when you were first exposed to YouTube. I look back, I see some posts from you up to over a decade ago. So you've been at it. It's nothing really new to you, but I mean, you kept at it. That's a long time to keep at it and to watch that growth go. Again, I'd say 50,000. Like, if you went to a magazine publisher and said, hey, we're going to publish a magazine on bass players, I don't think they'd say, yeah, you're going to get 50,000 subscribers. So I actually think 50,000 is a really good number considering the niche you're in. So talk a bit about being that YouTuber. I mean, you are. You're a recognized name. I wanted you on the show because I know your stuff from there.
Sure. Well, you highlight the fact that I've been at it for over a decade. That's very true. I think I was probably one of the early adopters where I at least signed up for a YouTube account when they first started in 04, 05. Didn't really do too much with it. And although it's been over a decade, I think that growth has been an intense growth in the past 2 years, I would say, since I started doing the daily vlog, since I became aware of people like Casey Neistat, Peter McKinnon, like these kind of daily vloggers and high volume YouTube content creators. And yeah, I think it's about any period of growth I've had in any of these platforms has pretty much come down to consistency. Wanting to and actually loving doing the work that it takes, which is a lot of work at the end of the day. It's especially the daily vlog. That was pretty intense. So it always started with loving the work, wanting to do the work. And then it came down to consistency. And the whole Hello Coffee Drinkers thing that came out of the vlog was I started to get feedback very early on in the first month of the vlog or so that people were, they got used to it in the first few weeks. They got used to that notification sitting in their inbox and they were waking up, getting their morning coffee and watching the vlog. So definitely I learned from that it was about consistency.
So let's hop. I want to hop to that and come back to YouTube a little bit. Talk to me about that Hello Coffee Drinkers thing and where that idea came from. I mean, yeah, you can now grab a mug and a t-shirt and stuff like that, but talk about what you were thinking about. Because again, I'm a marketing guy. So when I hear stuff like this, I always perk up because I found it so interesting. And again, watching you do it, and then watching people react to it and it becoming sort of like a catchphrase almost.
That is the catchphrase. It's like, you know, the, what is it? Kiss have the Kiss Army. You know, Gaga has what, the Little Monsters, the Justin Bieber has the Beliebers. On a very macro, micro, nano scale, I have the Coffee Drinkers. And that came out of the audience and that came from being engaged with the audience and listening to the audience. I wasn't just putting up YouTube videos and then ignoring the feedback from them. I also wasn't pandering to the point where, you know, I want to make slap videos at 400 BPM through 50 pedals at a time. But I definitely was engaged and listening to the audience. And as soon as people started saying like, oh, wow, morning coffee with Yannick. I forget. I should go back and look at the original comments from the beginning and see who really came up with the idea. It wasn't me. Full disclosure, I did not come up with Hello Coffee Drinkers. That was a coffee drinker, the original coffee drinker zero. And it kind of grew out of that and it became a catchphrase. And now I travel literally all over the world. And people who don't speak a lick of English are coming to the shows and they can get out the phrase Hello Coffee Drinkers. Which is fantastic, and it's branding. I hate using the word branding or being a brand. It feels a little mechanical and forced, although it just is what it is. But that is definitely something that came from the vlog and something that puts a smile on my face every time it happens. It's quite amusing.
Are you surprised if you think about your career and where it's at? And again, considering the trajectory and growth of those subscribers over the past couple of years on YouTube, around just how powerful a platform it is. Again, I think a lot of players, when they think of YouTube, they think, like, I got to spend weeks learning some sort of fill or song or cover to play that's going to impress an audience. And, you know, my loving of your work comes from you just talking. Like, it's just interesting to watch you go and talk and your care for the instrument. And I could care less about how many BPMs you could slap at. How do you look at it, though?
It's all about honesty. you know, like I was, there are a couple of things in there in terms of, you know, YouTube definitely wasn't the beginning for me. I was a super early adopter, and this is going to show my age, of MySpace, and really started
showing your age. Showing your age, Yannick, would have been BBSs. So you're doing fine. If it's just MySpace. I'm like, I remember having a 2400 baud internet modem. So you're doing fine. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I was, regardless, I was a fairly early adopter of MySpace and did way more in terms of subscribership and engagement, because I actually think their algorithms and their platform was just way better than anything that exists today. They just delivered it in such an abominable vehicle that it just died. But there were so many great references specific to what I do, and the fact that you could cross-reference influences and you could actually build an audience of people who really could be engaged in the kind of music you were doing stylistically. So I was up around 100,000 people very, very quickly on MySpace and carved out a couple of tours all around the world as a result of it, and meeting people and networking through that. So that was kind of the beginning of that. And I don't know if I'm amazed at this point, just I think because I've just been doing it so long. What I am amazed about is the fact that I kind of straddle, and I'm by no means unique in this, but I do straddle two very specific eras in my career: pre-internet, pre-social media, and post all of that, and the continuation and development of all of that. And I think where I fit into that, and perhaps what is not unique to me, but unique to some, to a few people, specific people in my, of my generation and my age range, is that unlike a John or a Vic or, you know, people who are, who obviously came before and are existing artists now, they built such a career on the pre-social media platform that their need for social media and engagement with their audience now is not as great as someone like myself, who had a career for sure and was already playing with Stern and Hiram Bullock and all these people beforehand. I definitely feel like I kind of don't have a choice. And at the same time, I feel it's also very honest. I'm not doing it because I have to do it. I actually enjoy it a lot. And the content and the creative process I have going on is very honest. And I think that's the key to the engagement with the audience and the growth of the platform for me, and the growth of the usefulness of the platform for me in terms of my career.
I think you're undervaluing also the fact that you don't shill every 2 seconds.
But I don't what every 2 seconds?
You don't shill. You're not pushing people to buy stuff all the time.
Oh, no. That's, you know, the purchasing is there. The products are there. I create them because I can't have the same conversation with people asking me the same questions over and over again. Yeah. You know, I can't explain how a 251 works or what my process is for a warm-up routine. It's like, okay, I'm going to put it in a book and it's going to be there. And when people ask me questions about it, I'm going to say, well, there it is. You know, in glorious Technicolor and in tab, if you really must go there. So I know that, you know, early on, I took a bunch of like online marketing classes, like some Brendan Burchard stuff and all kinds of things, when I started really getting into this and having a subscription based website and being a businessman, having a business, having a small musical empire. I started to learn about this stuff and the importance of telling my story and the importance of having something that people can relate to, you know, identifying an issue in my playing, in my life, and then coming up with a solution, or providing at least my process and what my solution was for it, and having people identify with that.
So let's cycle back in time from what I, what I can see. You started at age 11 playing classical guitar. I feel like you sort of shifted to jazz real quick when you were young.
Yeah, I was always interested in it. I think the fact that my dad was, that's what my dad was into. And even though my parents were divorced before I was 5 years old, my dad would send me all these cassette tapes. He would send me a lot of cassette tapes that he would dub from vinyl. He used to work at Warner Brothers back in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. Not like he was a record executive or anything. He ran the mailroom. but what he had was access to a lot of material and a lot of white labels and a lot of unreleased stuff and demos and all these kind of things. So he would send me these cassette tapes. He'd send me like Bitches Brew and Kind of Blue and like, you know, Headhunters records, all these classic 60s, 70s records. And for the most part, I'd toss them in a box and they'd end up in the attic because I was trying to listen to Michael Jackson and Madonna or what was ever on the radio at the time. But I'd listen to a few of them and that kind of, I think that kind of settled in to the subconscious a little bit.
So I'm just so curious. Whenever I hear stories like this, and I listen, I'm exposed to them frequently. I'm always surprised by it because I think back to my parents who stayed together and were together, but anything they liked, I raged against. I mean, I didn't, I wasn't going to like suddenly be down the, you know, listening to Oscar Peterson and they were listening to some, I mean, stuff now that we would consider to be real classic. But back then when I was young, it's like somebody needs to, you know, slap me in the face and point me to Ozzy and Metallica and Kiss and all that sort of stuff, or at least where I was at. I'm always fascinated when you've got a young person, I mean, in your early teens, if not your teens, and you become somewhat interested, infatuated, passionate about what is a very different genre than what would be anticipated for someone your age. I mean, it is still kind of crazy.
Yeah, and there are two stories that come to mind, like one of my earliest baby photographs in the highly embarrassing, you know, photo album is me in a onesie, aged, I don't know, 5 months old, 6 months old, with a huge pair of headphones on, laying on the floor next to the record player, and the caption is "Weather Report, Heavy Weather" underneath it, in my mom's handwriting. And then the other one is, you know, fast forward 17 or so years, and there's me like having rebelled against the fact that my mom listened to Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and all these folk singers when I was a kid. Going back to my mom and say, "Hey, mom, do you think I could borrow those records that Jaco played on of Joni?" You know, and my mom, like, big smile, like the "I told you so" face, and yeah.
That's why it's such an interesting thing to hear and see. Talk about, I'm curious about two parts of bass playing. One, when you first saw the instrument, and then, well, let's start there. When did you first see the electric bass?
You know, I don't know where I first saw it. I know that I was at a music center in South London at the Merton Music Foundation. And they had a bass guitar, and I was playing classical guitar at the time. I was playing trumpet and piano and all drums and all these other instruments, but I would pick up the bass and mess around with it a little bit. But the first time I really saw it being played to the point where I was like, "Oh, this is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life," I think I was maybe 15, 16, something like that. And I really wanted to be a drummer. And my friend Matt said, "Okay, so let's go to this jazz gig, local jazz gig in a pub in South London." I said, "Okay, who's the drummer?" He said, "Oh, it's this guy, but the bass player is really great." Okay, so we go to the gig. I didn't really care so much for the bass player. And then they started playing, and that was the moment. And that was a guy called Lawrence Cottle, who at the time was like major studio musician in London, was working with everyone from Clapton to Seal to Sanborn, doing movies, played on Headless Cross for Black Sabbath, like major, major bass player in the London studio scene. And that was it. That was a Sunday lunchtime. And I went out the next morning and had a few pennies saved up and bought a really super cheap bass. And that was it. And he lived super close to me, 2 minutes. And I found his number and I called him up and asked him if I could hang out, you know. And he spent 2 years mentoring me and taking me to every single gig and session and you name it, driving me around town and showing me stuff. Never gave me a lesson. I would ask him about harmony and about bass and technique, and he's like, "No, I'm not teaching you." But he let me record every single gig on a little dictaphone.
Why? Why was he saying, I mean, that's a weird thing to sort of have that type of mentorship and friendship, but why would he not teach you?
Greatest thing that he ever did for me, I think, because he was like, "Either you want this or you don't." He never said this to me, but I'm pretty sure this was, and I should probably ask him about this, but I think his attitude was, "Either you want this or you don't. And if you want it, you are going to figure it out. And if I tell you that E is the 9 on a D minor 9 chord, and then you can flatten that to the E flat to get an altered sound on the 5 going to the 1, and here's a sharp 5 and all these things, what is that? You know, that's just spoon feeding you." And of course, this is a long time before YouTube, but that's exactly what YouTube does now, is just kind of spoon feed the information, and people don't have to work for it. So I think that was his attitude there. It's like, either you want it and you're going to work for it, or you don't. And, you know, either way, I'm not teaching you.
That's amazing. That's like a very peculiar type of relationship, and profound too.
But it was amazing. I learned so fast. Like, my rate of growth was so rapid because I had to record all these things and go home after the gig and transcribe them and use my ear and develop these real-time reactive musical skills that I use every single day and have used every single day since that time. You know, probably the most intense period of study, regardless of all the universities and places I studied since.
I think it's becoming clearer to me, your comments about YouTube and earlier in what you just said about spoon feeding now, because you're right that when there's nothing present, you have to figure it out.
Absolutely.
And when there's everything present, maybe the fire or the sort of unknown of that tinkering with it is completely gone. I never thought of it that way, but you're right that it really does. It kills that sort of that spirit of innovation that I think you need to be creative.
Big time. You know, it's like I see this so much, the sentiment of this, and I'm sure it's a quote by someone huge, like a famous football coach or the, you know, Nelson Mandela or something. But the sentiment of where's your motivation? You know, I'm not saying that every artist or every great artist has to live in, you know, perpetual struggle in order to create great art. But a little friction here and there and a little necessity, you know, like, this should be a necessity and not a luxury. Your drive, I think, at least that's what makes it work for me. You know, now, of course, it's the overcoming the onslaught of media, of what's available. Like, I'm literally sitting at my desk right now in front of two screens where I have access to pretty much anything I want. And the desire to go look at old, you know, Jacko videos or, you know, Joni Mitchell concerts or something is strong. And to not do that and to actually like, oh, well, let me see who's playing live in LA this week. And let me actually go out to a show. And maybe I'm going to bootleg that show and then come home and sit there with my tape player and transcribe something that I haven't heard before. You know, the push-pull between those two factions is pretty strong. So,
yeah. So the second part of that question now is, when did you know that you wanted to be a player?
Same day that I met Lawrence. 100. Wow. I was all in immediately.
Having
forgot
never
about
played
the
instrument.
Yeah, I mean, I'd messed around with it, but I had never studied. I'd never, you know, I played classical guitar, so I was super lucky in terms of my technique that was going to transfer. Like, I had a massive foot in the door in terms of just holding the instrument and being able to create some sort of sound, you know, an understanding of fretted stringed instrument. So I was very grateful that I'd had an amazing guitar teacher, had someone who really taught me how to practice, taught me about real technique, left and right hand, finger style, posture, you know, the whole thing. But it was very immediate.
If someone were to ask, what type of music do you play now? Like, what's your genre? What's your reaction?
Run away and hide. I hate answering that question. It's the eternal struggle. I play improvised instrumental music. That is quite often melodic. That's not really, doesn't really roll off the tongue as easily as, well, I play jazz. You know, but also jazz hasn't really existed in 50 years or something. So,
well,
I'm reluctant to call it that.
Why do you say that?
I think jazz, when it was really at its peak and was an innovative art form, was also a political statement for a lot of people. It actually meant something. You know, it was a social commentary as much as it was an art form. And I think the circumstances are completely different. The epicenters of where that music grew are, the landscape is gone. It hasn't even changed. It's just disappeared. So I have a hard time calling what I do jazz, even though that is sometimes the easiest way to describe it to someone if you want to be quick about it and efficient.
And do you feel, putting jazz aside, that music or genres need to have that statement for it to live? Like, I mean, I'm thinking in relation to rock, and we could argue uh-huh. that the 60s were such a pivotal time. But then if you look at the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, each yeah. decade has this sort of fortitude that has pushed that genre forward in a different way. It may not uh-huh. be because of its roots in, you know, love for all or jazz in terms of, and I completely agree with you, in terms of it being a sort of the moment reaction to what's happening in society, but mm-hmm. the genre still lives and progresses. And that's where I guess the conflict is for me in what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that actually for the most part, the genre in jazz, the genre lives and regresses in a big way. And I think that, you know, music schools are sort of perpetuating a false kind of false hope of something that is out there once students have spent all this money and, you know, graduated or not and get into the real world. I think it's kind of a little, as soon as it kind of got, became academic and became a viable academic pursuit, I think that killed and regressed a lot of what it stood for in the first place.
So you had a good or bad experience at Berklee College of Music?
I mean, I barely had an experience. To be honest, I barely had an experience at all because I was only there for 3 semesters, but I would say it was good. And I still, despite having given you that damning quote of music the current state of jazz music education, I still recommend if someone asks me their my advice about going to a music school, whether that be Berklee or North Texas or wherever, I always say yes, go. Like if you have the means, if you have the money, if you have can get a scholarship, go, because that is still a place where a network exists. And I would say my experience at Berklee was incredibly positive because of that network. And because here I am 20 years later this year after Berklee, still working with some incredible musicians, some just amazing personal friends that came out of that network. And we still work together on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis. And that's quite a large crew of people.
I found it really touching watching your video where Victor Wooten was watching you. I think it was at NAMM.
Oh yeah.
And it really struck me like as a really sort of human moment where we sort of have these perceptions of players and what they can do and, you know, their YouTube channels and their success with their albums and their music and their tours. And watching you interact, it made me feel like I think I would sort of handle it that way as well. And I don't know if that's a statement on who you are and your humility or a statement on, again, what you talked about earlier in the humanity of what you bring forward. But I think it ties really nicely into what you just said about school and stuff.
Yeah. First of all, that was like nerve-wracking moment, you know, for me, even though I know Vic since many, many years. And, just being around, regardless of whether it's on YouTube or whether it's around a bunch of people, whether it's just me and him hanging out, I appreciate those moments so much. And it's the same with John, with Patitucci, you know, the whole thing about the high action.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was literally 20 seconds. We were hanging out for hours, but the 20-second little nugget of information about the high action, you know, and I just look back on that and think, wow, that was hugely life-changing for me. So whether I'm nervous or not, or anxious or in awe or starstruck or just what am I doing here, kind of, if that's my mentality, I'm at the same time, I'm always trying to be like, well, I'm going to learn something right now, no matter what. So just, you know, eyes and ears open, mouth shut, and try and, you know, make the most of the situation and try and remember everything that happens.
I've had the pleasure of having, you know, Victor's been on the show and John's been on the show, and then you sort of meet them in person at NAMM. And
yeah,
I find that they're actually two very iconic people, particularly because you have a very normal conversation. And it's only when you're walking away later when you realize, at least I have had those multiple interactions with them, where it's not just like a fan talking to them or someone who respects them, but just you had just a normal conversation.
Yeah.
And it's always a testament to me of the quality of the human when that happens, where you just feel like that was just a great conversation. And it just so happens it's someone that on any other given day, I would have been like, oh my God, I can't believe that's so-and-so.
Right. Well, you know, the way I introduced myself when you asked me at the beginning of this podcast was, you know, I'm a musician who just happens to play the bass. Well, really, I'm a human being who just happens to be a musician. You know, I think we lose sight of that. I do sometimes, absolutely. I mean, my whole life is focused on being human first, musician second, but I lose sight of that sometimes. And I'm very grateful, not just in this kind of small bass community of people like John and Vic and the Steve Baileys of the world and just these amazing people that are very positive being around. I'm just kind of grateful for it's very emotional, actually, I got to say, you know, when I think about all the people I know and I love and I'm fortunate enough to be around and interact with. It's like you said, Vic and John, especially, there is a great human element to that. And I try not to lose sight of that.
So I think it's a great segue to talk. I mean, you've done a ton of books. But to me, the most interesting book, as I'm sure you will not have to guess too hard, is Your Musician, Now What? So I'm curious, what is going on in terms of the cycle of the work you're doing, because you're putting out very specific books and courses, sure, and things like that, to then take a little bit of a step back and write this book, which has a pretty heavy focus on... actually, we talked about earlier, which is building the brand and what you can do,
sure,
to make, you know, beyond just making great music, what you need to do to make this work.
So You're a Musician, Now What? It's now 6 years old. I'm sure a bunch of those companies don't even exist anymore that I reference in there. But the overall concept is still the same. And it came out of kind of a necessity of not trying to have the same conversation over and over and over again, because there were so many recurring questions from fans and followers and friends about, you know, how are you doing what you're doing? And of course, why are you doing what you're doing? Like, why are you not so much in the traditional role of a bass player 100% of the time? Why are you not after so many gigs or trying to be a sideman or playing lots of records or do these kind of traditional so-called things as a bass player? And it kind of stemmed from the fact that in 2010, I'd been on the road a really long time. I think I'd played over 300 shows in 1 year with an artist, and I'd slept maybe 11 nights in my own bed. And I knew that for my own sanity alone, I didn't want to do that. That wasn't the life I wanted to carve out for myself as a musician. I wasn't having so much fun doing that as a bass player, even though there were great moments and I learned a lot from those experiences. That wasn't my end goal. And I'd had a podcast, actually. That was kind of how the online thing all started for me, like in 2005, 2006, something like that. And I'd really had some traction with it. It was like a 30-minute kind of radio show style thing. I'd play a little, I'd explain what it was I was doing. Maybe I'd feature some music, have a guest, something like that. Really simple. And I'd got a lot of followers. It had something like 100,000 downloads or something. So I said to myself, I know, I'm flat broke. You know, it's December. I talk about this in the book, you know, being in December of 2010 and not having January's rent and thinking, oh, this is a problem. I'm in my 30s now and this should not exist. I've just spent a year being quote unquote successful as a musician and fulfilling my perceived goals. And all of that was nonsense. So I was like, I know, I'll monetize the podcast. I'll get a dollar from everyone that's downloaded it and I'll make a fortune overnight. Of course, business doesn't work like that. Marketing doesn't work like that. And my good friend Bob Reynolds was at the time, tenor saxophone player Bob Reynolds, who I went to Berkeley with, was at the time developing his own saxophone subscription business in terms of making video content and charging a monthly subscription. And he sat me down for 2 days at his kitchen table and showed me how to use WordPress in the very beginning of December. And said, okay, off you go. And by Christmas Eve, I'd launched VideoBassLessons.tv. And by March of 2011, I had a ton of subscribers. And a year later, I was making a six-figure income from the website. And You're a Musician, Now What? Was the story of how that happened and technical things, emotional things, you know, philosophical things. And the book definitely needs an update in terms of the technical stuff, but the concept and the philosophy is still quite relevant, I think.
I feel like it used to be for players that there was sort of this lifestyle of, especially bass players, right? You're writing, music recording, you're mm-hmm. touring with someone or for yourself, or you're mm-hmm. teaching. And what your experience, I think, is demonstrating, and I think it's now a new opportunity, is that fourth one of doing that teaching part, but online, and that being its own. I think it's a very, very different type of business. And there's other players like you who are doing it. You're not by no means the only one.
No.
And I find that always so interesting, because when I speak to players, I'm always curious about, like, where do you feel most comfortable? Is it teaching? Is it touring? Is it in the studio? But when it comes to you, I feel like there's this added thing, this like sort of online business thing, which is a really important part of you getting your music out and you making a living.
Sure. And it also about having a life as well. You know, like it's very, you know, if you talk to non-musicians about, you know, there are people in my life every day that are non-musicians. I play a lot of tennis. I'm very active. I go to the gym a lot. I'm part of a running community. Like, these people are very far from the music world, a lot of them. And we talk, and, you know, a couple of days ago, someone said, oh, you know, you all ready for the race next weekend? I said, oh, I can't do that. I'm going on tour. And they, oh, wow, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to Singapore and I'm going to Thailand. And their face lit up like it was, wow, some fantasy, magical thing that was happening that they were quite envious of. But by the time I'd broken it down and told them that, you know, well, LA to Singapore is a 17 and a half hour flight, and I arrive at 10 a.m. and I do a clinic at 1 and play a show. And the next morning I fly to Bangkok and finish the show. And at 3:40 a.m. I get back on a plane to L.A. Their face was very, very different picture.
Yeah.
And you
they're thinking massages and beaches. You're thinking airport, hotel, gig.
Yeah. They're thinking private jets and the Four Seasons. And, you know, I like to fly business. I'm not going to lie. I don't sit in the back of the bus anymore. But it's, you know, it's not glamorous, you know, it's, and I think the online thing and having passive income, has been a great facilitator of having a life and not losing my mind and still maintaining a passion for creating music and for being an artist and being able to be in control of my schedule and not constantly wait around for an email or a phone call from somebody's management to tell me that maybe the gig is happening or maybe 2 years of work just got canceled for no reason.
So that's really interesting, because does it make you want to focus more on the business side? I mean, again, as we came onto the call, I heard you practicing in the background. And I know I get pulled in a million directions every day where I think about spending my time, you know, building the brand, working the online business, that sort of stuff. So how do you figure out how you're going to split your time out and what you're going to do? Because I guess to a certain degree, as you gain your success online, it's easy not to become complacent, but to just focus on that growth and not have to get on that plane and kill yourself.
Sure. Well, it's all about finding the balance. That's for sure. That's the impossible task. Even I think I have a pretty good balance, and I still find it almost impossible when I wake up and I think, oh, what is shouting the loudest? What needs the most attention today? You know, is it a customer service email from you know, Estonia, where somebody didn't get their download code on time? Or is it the fact that I have to learn, you know, all of Benny Greb's music before I get on the plane to go on tour? So it's about what screams the loudest on one level. And then it's about efficiency. You know, it's amazing. Like I say, people ask me that question a lot. How do you manage your time? How do you possibly fit all of these things into the day? And I say, well, don't underestimate how many hours there are in a day. You know, if you are really honest with yourself about what you actually do with your time rather than what you think you do with your time, you're going to find so much more space, so many more moments where you can be doing something. And at the same time, you have to pair that, if you're going to be successful and have fun, you have to pair that with loving the work. I think you have to love the work. And I'm just lucky that I do, whether that's practicing. And I got to say, lately, I'm on a bit of a practicing binge, and I've been managing to carve out between 3 and 5 hours a day on a regular basis, which is really fun. Or whether that's, you know, redesigning and relaunching the Annex Bass Studio, or working on the new book before Christmas, or whatever it is. You know, it's, you got to love the work.
So we talked about some of the people you've played with. A lot of names we haven't spoken about: Peter Erskine, Wayne Krantz, Mike Stern, Pat Metheny, Marcus Miller. I mean, it really is a deep bench of people you've had the chance to connect with. When you think about some of those names, is there any name that's still in your brain you sort of put your head down and shake? Like, I can't believe that that happened.
Oh, wow. Talk about being put on the spot. I was prepared for every other question you had except this one.
It could be someone that was just such a huge influence on you. Like, when I saw the list, for me, it was more of a Peter Erskine, only because of the connection to Jacko and that stuff.
Yeah,
was like...
I mean, yeah, I think about that. The thing is, with Pete, it wasn't like a one-time thing. It's been an amazing relationship over a decade, you know, playing on each other's albums and going on the road together and being in different parts of the world. So I'm unbelievably grateful for the fact that that exists, the fact that it happened and it still exists, and that's huge. And just being around people like that, you know, I've made it my mission, I think, throughout my career to be around people like that, that just know more, can do more, are more able, more capable, better communicators. Just, I'm always learning something when I'm around people like that. So yeah, for sure. All the people you mentioned, you know, Pat, like when I played with Pat in 07 or whatever it was, I couldn't sleep for 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, literally couldn't go to sleep because all I could think about was his time feel. And the fact that I was like 6 feet from him, hearing that in the room and playing along with it, changed my life. You know, having listened to all those records and having heard all the stories of how he pieces his solos together and edits and does all this stuff. And then you play with the guy live and it's perfection. You know, I have no idea why he pieces all his solos together, because the guy is obviously more than capable of playing anything he wants live or otherwise. So yeah, there are some huge moments. I'm more interested in some of the moments that are still to come, I think. And some, you know, I have a post-it note sitting here on my monitor that says John, Yo-Yo, Gabriel, and Brian. Hmm. So that's John Patitucci, Yo-Yo Ma, my friend Gabriel Santiago, great Brazilian guitar player, and Brian Blade. And that is an ensemble I would like to exist. And I just put that there, I don't know, about a month ago. And I want to try and manifest that, make that happen.
Dreaming up the next supergroup.
Yeah, but I hate the supergroup thing.
I know.
Yeah, you know, it's just I think of all of those people and how melodic they are, and think about like the combination of what we could possibly do together. Yeah, maybe it'll never happen, but it's a nice idea, and kind of really looking forward to things like that. You know.
Normally I would end right here, but I can't, because there's some there's some inside baseball business that we need to settle, because my buddies Corey and Kevin, who run NoTrouble.com, tell me that you guys have this sort of one-upmanship moment about apps. And so I was told that I can't end this conversation without asking you what are the one or two apps they need to know about right now.
Apps?
Yeah, phone apps.
Phone apps. Okay, well, this is news to me.
Oh, okay. They were saying that they've had conversations with you about phone apps.
Well, yeah. I mean, phone apps. You know what? I am trying to get away from the phone as much as possible. I was actually looking up my T-Mobile plan and saw that there was a no data option.
Oh,
like
okay.
The customer can refuse data. And it just takes up so much of the day if you let it. Like, it's really, really tough to get away from it. I don't know.
All right.
Shazam probably, because my history of music and listening to, I can never remember the names of songs. So Shazam is like one of the oldest apps out there, I would imagine. But that's probably the thing, besides playing online poker on my phone, that's probably the thing I use the most.
And as of this moment, we have Apple completely taking it over. So that's going to be, we'll see what happens to it now.
Yeah, that's something I should have you on my podcast to discuss. Just where it's all going.
That'd be great, you know, for sure.
And what the predictions are for the future, because it's exciting and incredibly scary at the same time. And I don't know what that means for the organic, analog nature of what we'll do as musicians.
Well, I think human first, musician second, as you said earlier, plays well.
Yeah, I'm all for that. I'm just worried that society won't actually keep that a reality. And we'll have to be really strong. And perhaps that's where music education should be shifting, just to remind people, like, hey, get your head out of your phone, get it into music, and maybe listen to an old record once in a while and remember why we're here, why we're all doing this, why we love what we do.
Well, Yannick, I can't thank you enough for your time. Let people know where they can best connect to you, the lessons, the books, all the good stuff.
Well, literally all the good stuff is one of my books. But Instagram is probably one of the best ways. Everything is at Yannick Gwizdala. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And you can see all my tour dates there on the front page of my website, which is YannickGwizdala.com.
Awesome, Yannick. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.